way. Please come on in and take a seat. We're going to begin in a minute. We're on a pretty tight schedule because we have chapel at 10 o'clock, so we don't want to finish after 9:50. I want to thank, first off, the dean's office, Russell Moore's office, especially Chris Cowan, for helping me set up all the logistics of this and approving this. We're so glad to have the archives here. They brought copies of some of A.T. Robertson's handwritten manuscripts and other things that you can glance at over there. Also, feel free during some of the discussion time we're going to have very informally up here. Lifeway is set up with A.T. Robertson books, at some of them at a very good discount. So A.T. Robertson's grammar and other things. And I want to thank, first off, as well, the participants. Really thank Dr. Nettles is going to start us off in just a moment with a 10 to 15 minute biographical sketch of A.T. Robertson. And he's going to close singing a hymn from A.T. Robertson's funeral. It was A.T. Robertson's "We're Going to Sing Together." You've hopefully received a copy of that as you've come in. Because it was this very day, 75 years ago, that A.T. Robertson passed away. Arguably the greatest New Testament scholar, the greatest Southern Baptist scholar that we've ever had in terms of worldwide influence and people who know of him. Also, we're very privileged to have Dr. Wayne Ward, a retired professor from Southern Seminary, who knows many. Dr. Robertson has many stories circulating about him, anecdotes and humorous oral tradition, and Dr. Ward is one of the carriers of that oral tradition that we want him to pass on, and as well even met Dr. Robertson as a child. Is that correct? When you were a child, you met Dr. Robertson, Dr. Ward? I think he met him when he was a child. Obviously, Robertson passed away.
Home and church.
Okay, so when Robertson was speaking in various places. Dr. Polehill's father worked as a grader, a Garrett Fellow, for Dr. A.T. Robertson. And in fact, Robertson gave him, after his 70th birthday, you hopefully received this as well, they listed Robertson's publications in a little pamphlet here, and Robertson signed off on that to Dr. Polehill's father, affectionately yours, A.T. Robertson. So we couldn't give you the original of that, but there you have a copy of the autograph of A.T. Robertson. So glad everyone could attend. We're going to respect the time of our participants, and I'm just going to invite Dr. Nettles to go ahead and give us a biographical sketch. Thank you for being here.
Yes, well, thank you for inviting me. I know exactly why I was invited. My brother's father-in-law is named Archibald, and my name is Thomas, and my grandmother's maiden name is Robertson. So you got it. Archibald Thomas Robertson, one of the earliest sons of a soon-to-be Reconstruction South and the seventh of 10 children, was born 6 November 1763. When he died on September 24th, 1934, 75 years ago, he had become intimately acquainted with and equally fond of three southern states. Virginia was the home of his birth, his extended family, and his first 12 years of life. North Carolina provided the environment of his preparatory education and his collegiate work at Wake Forest College. Kentucky, home of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary since 1877, was the home of his theological education and his professorial and writing activities from the fall of 1885 until his death 49 years later. Robertson's early years in Virginia are documented in a charming way by his own recollection and through his own hand in a 125-page notebook entitled Recollections of My Early Life. It was later printed by the Virginia Baptist Historical Society. Robertson's earliest memory occurred at 3 years old when he wore a red velvet suit on a trip to see his grandmother Martin in an adjoining county where he had turkey and ham gravy and biscuits and a lot of fruit, a trip of 25 miles punctuated by a delicious picnic. As Robertson remembered his days in Virginia, they were a mixture of Edenic delight and difficulties with the sweat of the brow and thorns and thistles. His was a home of hospitality, and some of the most prestigious names of Virginia Baptist life visited the family. He gained a keen interest in preaching in the final years of his Virginia days. Some of the former slaves had stayed on the plantation to work and help, and Robertson recalled with fondness a mammy that was kind and good to me. He also still exhibited, even through his scrawling chirography, an otherworldly fascination with a former slave who was a master of the bees, returning a swarm to the hive with his hands without a sting and robbing the hive without mask or gloves and never an angry bee assaulting him. Most of the 1,500 acres, however, never again saw the productivity of the antebellum days. Financial worries plagued the spirit of his father, who not only had lost the substantial income of a southern gentleman who owned land and slaves, but had been rendered useless in his profession of country doctor by a fall from his horse while attending some of his patients. The eldest son, Martin, took over the care of the land, and Archibald Thomas worked proudly by the side of his brother. Soon, however, their destitute condition demanded a move and a change of circumstance. Leaving two sons behind to harvest the tobacco and the corn, Dr. John Robertson took the other members of the family by train to Statesville, North Carolina. There he had bought a farm that was not yet a farm, covered with trees that they had had to fell and then stumps that they had to uproot. The work was grueling, but as Robertson recalled, life-transforming. Their dog, old Bob, did not like the new home and walked back to Virginia, never to return. Archer, as his mother called him, planted a flower garden for aesthetic delight and picked wildflowers for his mother on his way home from a day's labor. But for 3 years, saturated himself with the most grueling kind of labor, suckering, worming, cutting, and curing tobacco, milking cows, harnessing and hitching up horses, driving a wagon to the mill, cutting stove wood, plowing, chopping down trees, cutting logs, splitting rails, building fences and barns, shocking wheat, and cutting wheat and oats with a scythe and cradle. I did my part gladly and loyally, he said, proud to be at Martin's side and beginning to realize the burden that was upon him for the family. J.B. Boone, a wise and loving Baptist pastor, planted a church in the Presbyterian country of Statesville. The first baptizings caused a notable stir in the town. His mother and father were constituting members of the church that was founded, and soon his father was Sunday school superintendent and a deacon. During a protracted meeting in March 1876, Robertson says rather plainly and prosaically, "Josephine, Nell, Eugene, and I all joined. One of my playmates mocked me as I was baptized." Boone also provided in his home the first formal education that Robertson had. His first recitations came after dinner and after supper at his mother's side. Boone provided a more intentional and formal approach in a number of subjects, including math and Latin, and recognizing the potential of Robertson, managed to get the Yadkin Association to sponsor him as their beneficiary at Wake Forest College. While this opportunity meant room and board and tuition for Robertson, it also meant the loss of labor at the family farm at a time when the nation was in a financial depression due to the Panic of 1873. In a moving statement of appreciation to his older brother, Robertson explained how his brother made noble and painful sacrifices to support the family and gave A.T. the opportunity to complete his education. Robertson noted, "He made my career possible." He arrived on the Wake Forest campus in the fall of 1879. Robertson, because of the need to remedy deficiencies in his preparation for college, took 6 years to finish. He distinguished himself with excellence in all that he undertook, winning the French Medal, the Latin Medal, being selected as senior editor of the Wake Forest Student, attaining the position of valedictorian, and receiving 2 degrees at graduation of AB and AM. He failed, ironically, by the slimmest margin to win the Greek Award. His friends never forgave the awarding panel for this action. In preparation for the exam, Robertson read Homer, Xenophon, Thucydides, Herodotus, Aeschylus, Euripides, Demosthenes, Lysias, Plato, and Aristophanes. Greek had become a joy to him. He entered Wake Forest at 16 years of age, poorly prepared, and graduated brilliantly as a scholar in French, Latin, and Greek, and could have taken some further university work and returned to Wake Forest as a brilliant linguist in those three languages. Instead, he turned his energies to preaching over the summer in missionary labors in North Carolina. In the fall of 1885, he moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and enrolled in the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. In his autobiography, he said he did this after slight hesitancy, having been urged by President Taylor to become tutor at Wake Forest or to go to the University of Virginia with a view to teaching. His student days at the seminary were no less filled with study than college, but now he had the added energy consumption of regular preaching. He noted that he got great inspiration for biblical study from classes under Dr. John A. Broadus, who has been very kind to me in many ways. In this first year, he entered senior Greek and a special class in New Testament textual criticism. Dr. Broadus's delight in Robertson's grasp of the Greek was evident to all his classmates. One wrote in later years, "His discovery of Robertson was like one discovering a diamond mine." In addition, he was still active in other aspects of student life, having been instrumental in the beginning of the seminary magazine, and participated in a student group known as the Shakespeare Seven. About every 2 weeks, they studied a different drama or heard an analysis of a different Shakespearean character. During his second year, he contracted a case of typhomalarial fever that lasted for 5 weeks. Robertson regularly recorded events and contemplations in a diary for these years. These entries show a keenly observant person, increasing in his sensitivity to his personal failing and sin, and doubts as to whether he will ever accomplish the level of usefulness that he desired. On hearing Phillips Brooks preach, he recorded that he was rapid and eloquent. On hearing Joseph Parker, he observed striking, oratorical, not orthodox, fine voice. On his 24th birthday, November the 6th, 1887, Robertson wrote, "Beautiful Sabbath, had impulses to be a better man in the next 24 years of my life, if they come. The past is full of regrets, bitter and sharp. And yet God has been very good to me. When quite a boy, I prayed to God for an education. He heard my cry. Oh, shall I use it worthily? I need the help of the Spirit so much." Soon he recorded that in addition to his regular classes, he was studying German theology, foreign hymnology, patristic Latin, and Coptic. On Thanksgiving Day of 1887, after a magnificent meal provided by Boyce for the students, Robertson wrote, "Gotten wider views of life, a deeper sense of personal responsibility, greater consciousness of sin, and higher aspiration after holiness. Today I raise an Ebenezer and look to the future with trust in God. Let thy grace, Lord, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee." On Christmas Day, he pined, "My heart is heavy as I look toward the future. It may be distrust, but I wonder this Christmas evening by the fire if the longings of my early manhood will ever mature into a life of broad Christian culture and work." At the end of his final session in 1888, Dr. Broadus informed Robertson that the trustees were going to appoint him as an assistant to Broadus in homiletics and New Testament Greek. This decision involved a conference with another young linguist that had already been hired as an assistant and had taught Robertson in Hebrew, John R. Sampi. Sampi told the story at Robertson's funeral. Sampi had been overloaded with teaching duties, and it became obvious that another assistant was needed. Sampi says, "Dr. Broadus said in his fine judgment, we must have another young man to help. Dr. Robertson was the first in my mind. And then Dr. Broadus asked, do you prefer to take the classes in Greek and New Testament or Hebrew and Old Testament? You have the right of choice. Dr. Robertson and I had become friends, and I became his Jonathan. I said, this young man knows more Greek than I do, and for the good of the seminary, let me take the Old Testament." During his first year of teaching, which he began October 1st, 1888, we find this private observation made just before Thanksgiving. "To be honest, my life so far has had far too much of self in it. I pray God that may all be changed now. I want to live to the glory of God. I am a poor, worthless worm, as I never saw myself before." Sickness and overwork brought about frayed nerves and despondency, which showed itself both in the nature of his penmanship and in the frequent contemplations of worthlessness. Some of this, however, is a growing awareness of his absolute dependence on God for life and salvation, some of it an increasing sense of loneliness and isolation, and some an increasing awareness of the gratuity of divine blessing. May of 1890 found Robertson in deep ambivalence. In the last entry in his diary, he wrote, "My life has new hope in it now. I'm full of action and work and business. God is with me, and I believe that I'm happy. I will tell my journal a secret." He came to personalize his journal. He loved his journal and would tell the journal these things. "I will tell my journal a secret. I have been in love, and my love and I had a falling out. Now I wander around with no one to care for me. I'm afraid I do not know how to win a woman's love. Where and when will I find another whom I can love?" Robertson had to wait only a bit longer. In 1893, he discovered an all-grown-up Ella Broadus, the youngest daughter of his beloved mentor. They married on November the 22nd, 1894. 4 months later, his father-in-law was dead. The Robertsons had four children, Eleanor, Carrie, Charlotte, and Archie. Charlotte died, and on the day she died, the erudite professor paced his house with his Greek Testament in his hand, saying, "He raised the daughter of Jairus. Why not mine?" In 1896, the seminary became embroiled in the Whitsitt controversy, in which Robertson sought virtually to its end to salvage the presidency of Whitsitt. Even as a young man, he clearly emerged as a thoughtful and clear-headed leader of men. Robertson also gave leadership to the founding of the Baptist World Alliance. He made a conscious decision, however, not to pursue denominational leadership, but to devote himself to scholarly labors for the good of the church. In 1901, Robertson completed his Life and Letters of John A. Broadus, the first of 45 works to be produced in a 33-year period, including his Big Grammar, which is the size of 10 regular books. The story of its publication is a fascinating episode in itself. Upon its completion, James Hope Moulton of Cambridge, who had been involved in a friendly, scholarly race with Robertson to publish a Greek grammar based upon the discoveries in the papyri, said, "It is not only up to date, but the final on the New Testament." The Robertson corpus includes grammars, expositions, history, and character studies, plus a massive number of articles written for journals and Baptist papers. On the day Robertson died, he became ill during his senior Greek class in the afternoon. He dismissed them 30 minutes early, an event entirely unprecedented in his 46 years of teaching. Hersey Davis, in the class next to him, hearing the class leave and knowing that something unusual must be at hand, left his class, went to Robertson's office, and found his colleague in pain. He moved him to another office that was cooler, but soon decided to dismiss his own class and take Robertson home. Davis and Mrs. Robertson summoned the physician, Hugh Rodman Level. Robertson suffered a stroke within minutes of his arrival and died 5 minutes later. On Monday evening at 6 o'clock, Robertson passed. Classes were dismissed at the seminary for Tuesday and Wednesday, with memorial services being held each day at chapel hour. At the funeral service on Wednesday afternoon at 4th Avenue Baptist Church, R. Inman Johnson, professor of music at the seminary, sang, "O Love That Will Not Let Me Go," Robertson's favorite hymn. Sappy's final words were, "O Brother Beloved, you are now in the presence of our elder brother. O fellow worker, you have crossed over the river to rest under the shade of the trees. O comrade, O fellow soldier, receive from him the reward of your service as a true soldier. How soon till we meet again? Au revoir. Auf Wiedersehen. Till we meet again. It won't be long." Let's sing together, "O Love That Will Not Let Me Go." O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. O light that followest all my way, I yield my flickering torch to thee. My heart restores its borrowed ray, that in thy sunshine's glow its day may brighter, fairer be. O joy that seekest me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain, and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be. O cross that liftest up my head, I dare not ask to hide from thee.
I lay in dust life's glory dead, and from the ground where blossoms red, life that shall endless be.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nettles. I'll just give you a hand. That was a fabulous sketch. Thank you so much. That was very helpful putting him in context. But now we're going to go to more of the personal remembrances and maybe start with Dr. Ward, who actually met A.T. Robertson. Can you tell us anything you recall from those?
Yes, Iman, can you hear me? I've got to sit up. I can't talk sitting back in this deep seat here. You know, as Tom, I'll use the name I remember, as he was talking about him and giving his life, I said, what a shame that you young people did not know this man. He was a very exciting part of my life in the 20s, at which time he was coming every summer to our Van Buren Assembly up in Missouri. And by the way, when he lectured there, people came from every denomination. He was the most ecumenical of our professors at that time. I mean, everybody knew this man. Let me give you a couple of memories that Dr. Carver, who is my main oral source, gave about him. When he produced that big grammar, it was an enormous work, taking several years. Dr. Robertson evidently had, I don't know whether he perspired profusely or exactly what, but he would, between every class, he'd go back down to his office, which was the last one on the faculty wing. Only the lower floor was open at that time. It says 32 here. I'm not sure that's the number on it today. But it is the one on the north side at the end of the hallway as you go toward the chapel. And Dr. Carver had the office directly across on the other side. And he told me that this was the regular ritual. Robertson would go back down, peel off everything he could take off, and hang it up. He had a clothesline hanging up there in his office to kind of dry things out. In fact, he had several unmentionables hanging up on that thing with in various stages. He didn't take them to the laundry every time they got soaked like that. He'd dry them out and use them again. But that put him in an awkward position. We didn't have many women, you know, back in those days. In fact, they weren't supposed to be anywhere down there. It's like a monastery. And Carver said one morning he heard the usual ritual. Some student, apparently, very gingerly knocked on Robertson's door, and the ritual began. Who is it? He gave his name as best he could cough it up, scared like he was. He said, state your business, which I guess he did. He said, look both ways. Any women in the hallway? Only secretaries were female secretaries were around. It was a true monastery. And when he was assured that the coast was clear, he'd say, come. And the guy would come in, standing there shaking, while Robertson Carver said, would hold his pen down at the point where he was writing on the document on his desk. And he'd look up, but he wouldn't even move that pencil from his spot. He'd hold it right there, which was a little reminder to make it short, you know, and also not to have to hunt for his place again. And Carver came over because they got into some kind of an argument, which was frequent. I mean, Dr. Robertson, I wouldn't say he was irritated by students. He really loved students, but he was a hard-line and demanding professor, and he could work them over in class. You know, back in those days, they recited. Had to stand. And one of the terrifying prospects for every student back in the 20s in particular, teens and 20s, and even into the early 30s, was the fear of being called upon to recite in Dr. Robertson's class. He would sometimes work them over mercilessly, and I won't chase that rabbit now, but sometime you've got to hear the story of Charlie Howard from Buies Creek, North Carolina. Anybody know that name? Till this day, that, well, it still affects the seminary, what he did to that man. He didn't mean to hurt him as bad as he did, but it was a life-transforming experience for Charlie Howard. Well, back to this occasion.
May I?
Yeah.
Do you know, supplement that story?
Yes.
Just one bit.
Please
this,
do.
This idea of give and take.
You know me,
he was quite frightening in class, according to all the reports, but he also could take a joke. And one time he had one student reciting who was clear this student was really brilliant and knew the material, and
yes,
Robertson got
right.
excited about it and started going along with him, started adding things in, and eventually took over the recitation. He was so good. And the student eventually, when Robertson got through, he sat down and the student said, "What did I make on that?" And he said, "Oh, about a 97 out of 100. And he said, "Well, I think I would have made 100 if you'd have let me finish." And Robertson laughed and said,
that may have
"But
been
it was
Charlie
on thin
Howard,
ice."
who was a fabulous Greek student. But Carver came in to kind of settle that thing and get the student on his way before he was completely non-functional. And he said, while he was standing there, Robertson began to cry. He said, "Look at this." And he had his short grammar, which is, 10 books. He says, like, 10 books.
Big grammar, yeah.
Yeah. They were in manuscript sheets. He'd written them out longhand. And, of course, then they were typed up by somebody. But the sheets sitting from the floor reached up at least this high past the top of the desk. And he was crying. He said, "Carver, this is my gravestone." He said, "Scribner's tells me that I've got to raise, I believe it was $10,000 to assist in the publication of this book." He said, "I'll be bankrupt. My grandchildren will be in debt over this book." And he was really crying and upset over that. Carver tried to reassure him, but he said, among other things, "Dr. Robertson, you are our window to the world. Nobody knows anybody at this seminary except you," which created a few problems, I would say, of jealousy and concern. The burdens that Robertson carried for his children were also very heavy. Archie, his boy that later worked for the Courier-Journal, and I knew him quite well. His father was the patriarch at the Fourth Avenue Baptist Church. I mean, each of the big powerhouses at the center had a church. Dr. Sappy had Broadway. That had been his church from the beginning. Carver was the patriarch at Walnut Street. So they didn't gang up in one church. The ones that were well known and everybody came partly to see them. Students would attend the church to hope to hear them or meet them. There is a longing which you feel to know your professors on an intimate basis. And Carver was not as approachable. I mean, Robertson was not as approachable as some, but he could be very kind and gentle. Now back to what happened that day. Carver said, "I went back with him up to the classroom when he got all his attire on, and he said he was really struggling with the burden he was carrying to lecture. And he had up on his feet that day reciting Charlie Howard from Buies Creek." Charlie Howard had been the best student. Well, he took his junior college, I think, there at the little Buies Creek school that had been around for a while. Then he went to Wake Forest and graduated with the highest honors from Wake Forest. And when he came to this campus, he was already known as a Greek scholar. When Robertson had him up that morning reciting, that bored in on him, he realized he had a winner. And, usually it was so painful that Robertson would let him off the hook pretty soon, let him sit down. But he kept Charlie up till the bell rang, and something that wasn't very common back then. They actually gave Charlie Howard a little approval with applause. I'm not sure how he took that, but here's what happened. The next day, in the afternoon, in fact, Charlie Howard, who had the tenderest heart of any man I ever knew, cared for everybody. And he, a guy he barely knew, who was a member of the class, but he had gotten typhoid fever. You know, back in those days, typhoid fever would flat out kill you. And he went over to the home of this student because his wife had called Charlie and said, "Can you get somebody to help us? I'm getting sick, and he's going to die, I'm afraid." And Charlie Howard, with his own money, went out and got some doctor that would make house calls and spent the whole day, and as it turned out, the entire night caring for his buddy over there, which meant that when he got ready to come back to class, he knew the rule which Robertson had. If you are not prepared for some legitimate reason, illness, somebody dies, you put on my desk before the class an excuse explaining why you're not prepared, and I will not call on you. But Charlie Howard misjudged that day. He said, "He won't come back to me. I was up all the whole period yesterday." He got there late, fighting traffic, I guess, to get across on the one old bridge we had at that time across the river. And when he came in, just as the prayer was being said, I think he waited with somebody, but he slipped into his seat. And Robertson opened up the roll, and he called him again. "Howard! Brother Howard from North Carolina." Oh, his heart sank. He got him up, got him started again. And he did pretty well until he began to ask him about some of the assignment that was to be read that night. And he stopped and he said, "Brother Howard, you're not prepared, are you?" "No, Dr. Robertson," and he began to give his reason. He just cut him right off. He said, some of the people who were there that left their testimonies of this say it was the worst tongue lashing they ever heard in their lives. And Howard ran crying from the room back to Mullins Hall where he lived. But at the close of the class, three or four of the guys, including some graduate students who had a little more clout, you know, they were required then, and all through Dr. Davis's tenure, all of his graduate students, which sometimes could number 50 or 75, had to occupy the seats around him, you know, like a little senate. And they got him and they said, "Now, Dr. Robertson, this poor man was devastated. You just don't know how much that hurt him." He said, "Well, I didn't mean to hurt him. He knows my rules." They took Dr. Bob, though, and God bless him for this, went over to Mullins Hall. Charlie Howard was packing up all of his things, already had a suitcase ready to go. And they began to talk to him. And they said, for once, Dr. Bob seemed really tenderly concerned about it. But as they talked, he got angrier and angrier. He said, "But you knew my rule. All you had to do was get somebody to send, to put a note there for you." And there was a shouting match till they had to pull Dr. Bob out of the room, and Charlie Howard left the campus that day and never set foot on this campus again.
Let me give you a follow-up on that.
Yeah, please do.
Which no one else knows. My father-in-law studied under Dr. Robertson. He came down with typhoid fever. He said, "You know, I knew Dr. Robertson well." I said, "How? Because you barely got to the seminary when you had to go home because you were in the hospital for a month with typhoid fever. He said, "Because Dr. Robertson visited me every day."
I can believe that. What a man of contradictions.
And I want to give time to Dr. Polhill.
I've rattled on here.
It's a fantastic. We could sit here all
anyway,
day.
Anyway, that man later I brought him to the campus here. We were together in evangelism conferences.
Well, Wayne, I want you to also help me with one other thing.
Okay.
The story about his being in his underwear, did it actually happen that one day it was a young female student who knocked on the door?
Carver never confirmed that, but that story...
That certainly is going around. Yeah, yeah. I heard it many times. Y'all probably heard it as well.
When we were together in evangelism conferences and state conventions, I brought him back to the...
Well,
Let Dr. Paul Hill finish this one. Yeah.
So if you haven't heard that story, as the story goes, she was, of course, taken aback immediately, and he was terribly embarrassed, and he tendered his resignation to Dr. Sampi, which Dr. Sampi refused to accept.
Over there.
Now, that's the story for what it's worth.
And I do want to hear a little bit about your father working for Dr. Robertson, too, if you would, Dr. Paul Hill. Tell us a little bit about that and about your connection through Dr. Davis, and you know a little bit about his children that Dr. Ward mentioned as well.
Yeah. My father did great for Dr. Robertson, and he actually helped him proofread that shorter grammar, and his name is mentioned in the preface. But Dad told me some things about Dr. Robertson that surprised me. I was surprised when I came home from the seminary and was telling my dad about higher criticism that I had learned, source criticism and that kind of thing. Because I knew that they didn't teach that in the seminary in his day, back in the 30s. Dad knew it better than I. He, in fact, corrected me at a couple of points. And I said, "Where did you learn this?" He said, "I learned this from Dr. Robertson." He said, "They had a double standard in those days. The master's students, they never taught higher criticism to. The doctoral students, they expected to know it backwards and forwards."
Right.
So he said, "That's where I learned it." Of course, a bit different from our day, but that's the way it was. He told a story that happened to him. His father-in-law, my grandfather, had an eighth-grade education. He grew up during the Civil War and had to support his family in the years afterward and never got more than an eighth-grade education. And he'd come to Louisville to visit my parents. My father was a student here. And they invited Dr. Robertson over for dinner, and he came. And my grandfather, with this eighth-grade education, asked him, "Dr. Robertson, what writing would you recommend to me, because I'm a Sunday school teacher?" And he said, "Well, what you need to do is to get a set of my word pictures." Well, if you're familiar with his word pictures, you know, they're studies on the meanings of the Greek words, and I can't picture an eighth grader, education person doing the word pictures, but that was his recommendation. You know, that was the level he was on.
Wow.
There's one story, though. You were talking about the grammar. You remember he did mortgage his house, take out a second mortgage to pay for that thing. But were you here when Oscar Kuhlman visited the campus?
Yes.
Kuhlman was a guest lecturer, and he was a very famous German, French, he taught at both Paris and Basel. He was a very famous New Testament scholar back in the 60s and early 70s. And he had an audience with Pope John the 23rd. And he was talking to the graduate students, and he said, "You will be interested in this." He said, "When I went in to see the Pope, he had been working on his Greek text, and he had his Robertson grammar open in front of him. And I asked him, 'You are using that English grammar?' He said, 'Yes, it's the best one available.'" So there is, from the Pope himself, a recommendation of Dr. Robertson's work. You can't get much more ecumenical than that.
I'd like to hear actually from Dr. Paul Hill and Dr. Ward both about his children, because as he was very harsh in the classroom, and you say he had these stories of compassion too, that he apparently embittered some of his children towards him, or at least that's What can you tell us about that?
Well, I can speak for Carrie. You could speak for Archibald. Carrie was his daughter who never married, and she had an estate, a fairly large farm. And a member of our church, Linden Baptist Church, took care of her farm for 47 years. His name was Arthur Gowan. And Mrs. Gowan gave me some things before she died. She just died a few months ago, that had belonged to Dr. Robertson, that Carrie had and had given to her in her will. But she told me that Carrie, as I say, who never married, was somewhat bitter toward her father. Never really did have anything good to say about him. And in her opinion, she was an avowed agnostic.
And the son, you had some interaction with his son.
Archie.
who apparently rejected the
like,
faith.
Like some other preacher kids I've known, professor kids. He resented the fact that he never had a father at home. He was much. And on Sunday morning down at the 4th Avenue Baptist Church, where Robertson always taught a Sunday school class when he was here, and Archie would slip out with some of the boys, and he had to go one Sunday morning, his father did, to see him in jail because the police had picked him up. Church, and
let's get this on tape here.
Yeah,
we
need that.
Here.
I am, and finding these old whiskey bottles, you know, and wine bottles, and they were actually drunk, and got carrying on a little bit, and somebody came and got Robertson out of his Sunday school class, said your boy's down here, you got to go, and the report that came back from Carver on that was that he was so tender and gracious and say, explaining, it's my fault. I don't have time for that. I haven't taken care of that boy like I should. And he was out there misbehaving during Sunday school. Well, in the following years, Archie became, as I said, a reporter for the Courier-Journal and wrote a book about his father. If you want to learn a lot about A.T. Robertson, his son, Archie's namesake, tells you the good and the bad, the up and the downs of his father. I highly recommend that to you. And I believe you had, you knew him too, didn't you?
Not very well, not like you did.
Archie
no.
was a rebellious son, I'll say.
Did he ever repent as far, I mean, come to faith in Christ as far as you know? Archie, is he? Or what's the...
I know he was mad at God. If he ever became, well, he'd already been baptized. His father baptized him there at 4th Avenue Baptist Church. And he just was rebellious. And until he died, as far as I knew, he never had anything to do with the church. He was a very much appreciated columnist or writer for the Courier-Journal. And he was something like a religion editor before we had religion editors, and I remember a time or two when he was so harsh in his criticism of some of our churches or our religious issues that they finally put him into another department. he didn't write religious.
Let me ask a story. I've heard the story about the underwear. That's one that's circulated in the Pope. But there's a story about where he took someone to task in class, you know, reciting bam bam insulting, and then. I don't know if this is true. So he found out later the person's wife had died. Mm-hmm. He came in the next day and ripped his shirt off in the class, repenting. Has anyone else heard that?
He felt responsible. I don't know about the tearing his shirt in the class, yeah. But I know that, he blamed himself for everything. He blamed himself for his wife's death. He blamed himself for his son's behavior. He just took the whole load on him, so he felt responsible.
Dr. Nettles, in your research, did you run across anything with his reflections on his children and their path, or did that?
No, I had a question though. Dr. Polehill said that Carrie was not married. I know that the last part of the book
she may have in her last years, but she.
Well,
years, she
there was
did.
A note that I read said that that of course Charlotte had died.
She died at 17, didn't she? Like
yeah,
very,
yeah
very
she
young.
Died, yeah.
And one son, I think, had he had four grandchildren at the time that he had died. So he had had four children, and it said that he was actually able, that Carrie actually married like 3 months before he died.
Oh, okay.
It's what this, but I don't know.
That could well be.
And then that he was able to plan the wedding of Archie before he died.
I was going by that brochure I didn't turn, you know.
Okay.
And she was not married in his 70th year.
I think that Dr. Robertson had such a deep sense of responsibility to be successful that he drove himself all of his life. And I think this is what made him, in one sense, ignore his children. He had been reared, as I said, he was one of the earliest sons of a Reconstruction South. He had to work hard. They moved to North Carolina when he was 12 years old, and for 3 years he would just work from Candle Cane. If y'all probably understand that, that's what we use in Mississippi, from Candle Cane. That means when you can't work, you can't work. It developed some sort of strange physical characteristics in him because of the stretching of the muscles at that young age. He had oversized hands in his diary, he continually talks about wanting to be worthy of the sacrifice other people have made for him, especially his older brother, who worked hard and had great potential. And Robertson felt that he was one of the most brilliant of the children, but he gave up all his opportunity for college and everything in order to work so that the family could live and Robertson could go to school. And so he felt this driving sense of needing to succeed. And it was not just psychological. It was a sense of discipleship before Christ. And so I think this did create a sense in which he expected excellence not only of himself but of all those around him. He knew how hard he worked. He expected that of his children. He perhaps did ignore them in just normal child things, except there are anecdotes at the back of the book by Everett Gill that are some charming anecdotes about remembrances that his children had. And of course, Gill just put in the good ones there.
Yeah.
So I don't think that it was complete bitterness. On one occasion, he said that when the grammar was completed, he promised his children they were going to go down to the Seelbach and have a turkey dinner.
Yes.
And so when it was completed, he did it. He carried them down there and had turkey with all the...
Archie mentions that. Yeah. He felt...
His bibliography, you've got a list of his works in that brochure that we handed out. That was put out the year before he died, his 70th birthday. And it's a complete bibliography with the exception of a posthumous work. He had written the manuscript, but it hadn't been printed. It wasn't printed until 1935. And that's Epochs in the Life of John. He had a policy that he would publish a book every year. And if you'll look, you'll see that every year there's a book published. I remember Dr. Wayne Oates took over that same policy, and he said he got it from Dr. Robertson, that you should be able to publish a book every year. And when I was doing a commentary for the Lifeway, Sunday School Board in those days, they were talking about royalties, and they said, you'll be surprised at this. Now, this would be, around 1990, something like that. They said, you'll be surprised at this, but the largest paychecks we make a year out, every year, for royalties is for the Robertson estate. Nearly how many years after his death?
Amazing.
Still selling more of his books than anybody else.
Wow. And we're just about out of time, but talking about his family, it reminded me of another story I just seeking confirmation on. Of course, he lived right across the road on Rainbow Drive in a nice house there. But was his wife killed, hit by a car on Lexington Road?
At the dog leg here where Stilts goes into Lexington Road.
Okay.
First stoplight in the whole east end of Louisville was put there after she was struck at that.
She was struck at that intersection.
Walked from Rainbow Drive right up, crossing there. Dangerous crossing to this day. Be careful, drivers.
Well, we need to respect the chapel schedule today, which starts in about 10 minutes. So I just want to thank these gentlemen for being here. let me encourage you as well to take a look at Dr. Hatfield's shirt that has A.T. Roberts on there. That's nice. Mm. And remember, there's discount Lifeway books. I assume, Terry, those will be available in the Lifeway bookstore as well. A.T. Robertson's books over there. Ask Dr. Coppinger. Dr. Coppinger's father knew A.T. Robertson as well. I'm sorry we ran out of time to tell that story. So thanks for being here.